and welcome to episode 5 of Policy Unpacked. My name is Alex Marsh. I've been away for a few months, busy with other things, unfortunately, but today I'm back to talk about real estate. In the US, local and regional government for many years has used a range of mechanisms, fiscal mechanisms, regulatory mechanisms, as a means of delivering key services, infrastructure, affordable housing. And in an era of austerity, in which resources are perceived to be increasingly constrained, governments elsewhere are keen to look for lessons, see whether there are policies or instruments that might be transferred to different contexts in order to deliver the services that cities need in order to continue to function and to thrive. So there's a range of issues around real estate that we'll explore today, and I will be doing so in the company of my good friend and colleague, Graham Squires. So, today I'm here with Graham Squires, who is currently a senior lecturer in planning and real estate at the University of Birmingham. And he has recently published a report through RICS, Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors, on the future financing of real estate development in cities. And that's based on some work he did in California, in the Bay Area, looking at various types of intervention in the real estate market. Welcome, Graham.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's all right. No problem. So just going to explore this. I mean, clearly we're in a context where governments are strapped for cash. Cities are strapped for cash. We're thinking about, ways and means, new ways, innovations, ways we can generate resources to put in services or infrastructure, whatever it might be. So I'd be interested really in starting off by just asking you, what is policy in this area, real estate development, cities, capturing value, what's it trying to achieve?
Okay. What it's sort of trying to achieve is sort of on a micro scale, trying to manage public resources a lot better, but on a more macro level, trying to engage multiple stakeholders to try and maximise budgets, whether that's within local authorities, whether that's in central authorities, whether that's say developers who are part of the process who are trying to make their schemes more viable. It could be mission-based organisations that are trying to further their social cause. Could be residents who are sort of expressing their interests and putting pressure on either the development industry or the regulatory organisations to try and maximise their own well-being. So that's the sort of some of the sort of more macro context that's going on. And I suppose the overarching element is, as you suggest, it's sort of within this era of austerity, a push towards more sustainable and resilient cities. So we're sort of trying to look at the instruments within finance to see how that can lever a smarter and a more efficient change within cities.
Okay, so could you, start by basically giving us a feel for sort of what are the sorts of broad approaches that would be used, what we're talking about, if you like, in terms of using finance via real estate development, what sort of broad categories of things, if you like.
Okay, when particularly looking over the Atlantic into the States and looking at that sort of Anglo-Saxon model, which sort of differs slightly to the sort of more Western European social model, we've seen a more slightly more commercial orientated approach, even though it is within this sort of more social, environmentally mission-based work. As you'll see from the report, it focuses more on affordable housing as one particular remit of real estate development. So what we see is a partnership approach that seems to be emerging over the Atlantic. Something that's started to emerge in the UK, and we can maybe talk about lessons towards the end of towards the end of the piece. But there's certainly a consolidation, a greater partnership, and that's sort of reflected in whether it's cause and effect. I'm not sure, but there's certainly a reflection in finance and these blended instruments that are starting to be used, whether it's international level, federal level, local level, and the importance of the city level and city administrations that tend to have a great amount of power. So that sort of feeds into interest across the pond in terms of localism in the UK, for instance, if it was from a UK perspective, in terms of how cities, if they're beginning to gain more powers, how they can lever change. So the approach is sort of looking at sort of probably more of a devolved approach to financing cities, partnerships.
So how, just on that issue, point you mentioned, how are those partnerships assembled? Are they sort of, does the local government broker sort of partners? Are they all multi-stakeholder, or do they come in different flavours, if you like?
Different flavours, I say. I mean, it's probably the best way to look at it. I mean, traditionally, it's the development industry that you know, they've got a profit motive or an investor return motive, and then they'll approach the local authority to see whether that's feasible. City administrations will have their own rules and regulations that they'll be able to control, whether that's by direct regulation. It could be, you know, you have to provide a certain percentage of affordable housing within a zone, or a certain percentage of, or multiple of units within a whole development site. So it's traditionally comes from the development sector, but there's a whole raft of different angles and institutions that shape change. And from what we've seen, from what you'll see in the report, is paradoxically this quite a federal influence on what goes on in affordable housing, which is sort of quite interesting given the sort of US free market model that's often seen as the dominant narrative that goes on.
So one of the things that you mentioned in the report as important in sort of shaping the way this develops is the Community Reinvestment Act. So that not everybody might be familiar with that. So what does that entail?
Yeah, with the Community Reinvestment Act, what we're looking at is a federal act in the 1970s that ensures that banks are lending responsibly and they're lending to socially responsible causes. One of those causes is affordable housing. So one of the schemes that are used within that Community Reinvestment Act is the ability to distribute low-income housing tax credits. And by distributing those credits, they can be traded. And ultimately, if a bank is seen to be lending these credits or distributing these credits, it will help their credit score, and if their credit score is favourable, that means that their opportunities to join up with other banks is encouraged. So there's incentives for banks to have a social responsibility in what they do.
So you started there. Tax credits is one of the sort of more specific instruments. So just moving on to think a bit more about it, because it's not just tax credits. Am I right in thinking there's also, you know, tax exemptions under certain circumstances, or you know, special taxes, or there's a range of sort of tax tweaks that are possible that fall under this category. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a whole blend of different financial approaches and at different levels, and that's what I sort of tried to bring out in the report. So, federal level, I sort of brought out this credit approach. At city level, there's certainly a lot of in the Bay Area bonding that's gone on over a number of years.
So what does that feel like? I mean, bond, you know, not in detail, but sort of broadly speaking, what does that mean?
For me, if we use the example of tax increment financing, for instance, that I've done some work on in the past, that's subsequently now been disbanded as an instrument given the demise of the redevelopment agencies, mm-hmm. in California. For reasons of state funding mm-hmm. collapse. But TIF funding that if I give an explanation, and they have morphed into different types of bonding, but TIF is in essence a value capture instrument where if some money is put into a particular scheme for infrastructure, say for a piece of rail, that money that's been put forward as a bond from the government will eventually be repaid, say over 20 years. And given that there'd be an expectation in land value uplift and property uplift, the greater value that has been created will be able to pay off that initial bond in time. So that's quite sort of quite an easy way to sort of explain what they do. But for this bond to take place, it was quite regulated in terms of making sure that it had a reason to be introduced, because if land and property is going to uplift in any way, why bond it in the first place? So with the TIF projects, it was essential that it was dealing with blight, so it had that sort of regeneration, renewal element attached to it. However, with that being pulled, it's sort of morphed into different bonding instruments that are not necessarily based on blight. So it starts to become a little bit more commercial, a lot more risky in the way that they're used. So there's certainly a layer of regulation that's sort of been stripped away as these redevelopment agencies have sort of fallen away.
Okay, so that's sort of one sort of package of sort of measures. I mean, other things that you touch on in the report, I mean, there's some, you know, some sort of inclusionary zoning, and I like the term upzoning, which is not one I'd come across before.
Is it Americanization? Building upwards.
Building higher, essence, yeah. To create more value.
Yeah, which sort of ties into sort of, the compact city, urban task force type approaches, new urbanism, trying to contain cities, reduce urban sprawl. So a simple way to engage with the development industry to make it more compact is to, but be able to carry on building, is, as you say, you just build upwards. So just a swift change in regulation can make that happen. But that obviously has implications, whether that's socially or environmentally, you know, right to light, especially in sort of boom areas that I was looking at in the case study in San Francisco, and people's views being restricted, and issues over, well, is this symbolic of a yuppification of San Francisco, and is this really the way we want to go? Should we sort of think a little bit smarter about how we develop cities? So there's that upzoning element, and sort of connecting to that is rather than building upwards, there could be a smarter way of connecting cities within the Bay Area, with, you know, 109 cities in that area and sort of 9 counties. There's maybe transit orientated developments that can spread that pressure, you know, environmental pressure and social pressure, over a wider area as well. So that's something that can be integrated into the financing models as well.
Right. So it's very much about not housing in isolation, it's thinking about the system, the urban system.
That's right, yeah, and I think I called it sort of joined up sector approaches. Mm-hmm. And there was interesting cases with connections between housing of vulnerable people and housing of low income people, but also within that sort of social policy bracket in terms of poverty, but there's also sectoral connections to, say, senior housing, mm-hmm. As it referred to in the States, and how if there's potentials to house seniors within these particular affordable housing schemes, that will reduce the opportunity cost of paying for healthcare problems of seniors who might be in poorer quality housing.
So again, it's that joining up thing. Exactly. Thinking about the health budget, thinking about the housing, and saying, actually, if we invest over here, we save some money over there. So
exactly.
It's that joining up.
I mean, there
are other things. I suppose impact fees are a bit like Section 106, aren't they? I think is one of the things which they have in the US. But you also mentioned housing trust funds as something which is emerging. I don't know if I've come across that before.
Yeah, I mean, it's in essence, it's a pooled set of funds that the city can hold on to as a capital fund year on year, whereas traditionally, say in the UK, an amount of money would only be held for a year and potentially lost the following year or shrunk the following year. But this is, and in addition, there'd be some central government controls on what that pot of money can be done with by a local authority. But in the States, there's a lot more autonomy within these housing trust funds, where various different organisations can put money into this pot, and then the city administration, which might also be a county-controlled zone, because with San Francisco, it's city and county. They'll be able to think more strategically about that, how that pot's used, what they hold back, what they use as incentives to bring people into the process and shape the city in a more controlled way. It's like with the redevelopment agencies that were before funding was pulled, the redevelopment agencies held a lot of resource and a lot of capital funds that they could redistribute. And with the pulling of redevelopment agencies, there was a lot of discussion about what to do with those surpluses, because you know, the TIF money that was being put into redevelopment agencies was sort of 20% of particular projects. So, you know, you think about 20% worth of development, sure. It's a significant amount that can be used towards, let's say, non-market dynamics that are going on. So say if there's a brownfield site that needs to be regenerated or renewed, there's going to be a lot of costs that are needed to make that happen. So this pot of money enables those upfront difficult costs that a developer wouldn't necessarily put
forward. Decontamination or that sort of thing. Get it to the point where it can be built on.
Rather than building on green belts.
You mentioned when we just touched on upzoning just a bit earlier about sort of the reactions of local residents or population. So I guess moving on to that thing about sort of stakeholders and who's involved in this process and sort of what they're looking to gain. I'd just be interested in your view. You know, have you a sense of you know, some of these are relatively sort of opaque financial vehicles. Some of them are rather more about shaping the urban landscape more directly through zoning or whatever. I mean, have you got a sense of which ones are sort of politically more popular or which ones meet with more resistance? Or, you know, have you got a flavour for how it's, you know, how these things are used or how they're received?
Yeah, I think the most, incendiary and interesting debate that was going on at the time that I was in San Francisco.
Which was late 2013, yeah? Roughly?
Be sort of around October, Twitter got floated on the stock exchange there. And Twitter had been encouraged to move into a downtown area of San Francisco that was a previously rundown area. And the city mayor has encouraged Twitter to move there via tax exemptions. And this was on employment tax. So as well as talking about property taxes and the differentials between, you know, tax on a zone, tax on a property, say sales tax, which is a significant part of municipalities' revenues, is also employment tax as well. So the tax breaks given to Twitter, who are ironically floating for billions of pounds, this is in an area that's deprived, becoming gentrified, people working in Palo Alto, Mountain View, Google, Apple, etc. Their workforce wanting to work in a youngish, dynamic area, so there's lots of yuppification, and gentrification going on. So there's an interesting tension I found with the what the city wanted to do in its wider strategic vision, but also within the residents and how they saw the way the city was going. So there were protests going on outside Twitter, which, you know, a couple of blocks down from where I was discussing some of the issues with the city council. So that tension's there, where the city are seeing a very strategic view of how they want the city and the wider Bay Area to go, given all the different booms and declines in different zones, and that contrasts to what the residents were experiencing either in that locality or more broadly, seeing that as a central focal point to raise their frustrations on multinational corporations, etc. So. However informed they were of the wider strategic vision of the city, because there's certainly on that west coast, as you know, there's quite a strong social mission that's there and a strong environmental sensibility that's there, but also quite a revolutionary sort of mindset, you know, given the history of San Francisco and Berkeley as well. So there's certainly some residential tensions to how the city saw development and how that contributed to the public purse.
Okay. So I suppose if some of these mechanisms are capturing sort of 20% of the value being created, or if that's of that order, I mean, I was just reflecting on it. You know, in the UK context, under sort of localism, we've had this sort of pushback from developers about saying some of these commercial schemes aren't viable because you're trying to extract so much via Section 106, and we want to in austerity, and we want to renegotiate this, so actually we remove some of the affordable housing requirements, so actually then it becomes. Fine, well, we've had those sorts of discussions. Is this a sort of regime that the sort of private partners or the developers sort of just accept and work with, or is it sort of contested politically? So actually, we don't think we should be contributing this much to these sort of social purposes. I mean, how, what's the sort of balance of power, if you like, in the in these sorts of
depends. I think it depends on the city and city strength. I mean, the core of the power in the Bay Area being San Francisco, and they've got a very strong vision on how they want affordable housing to go. So they're very take a strong leadership and a tough line on development. You know, if you their view is, if you want to do development in this city, you play by the rules, and everyone's clear. You know, it's just a cost of doing business, I think is probably the way that, the way they describe it. But that's probably the more commercial development sort of side of things. With the affordable housing development industry, and it is an industry in itself, you know, for surplus rather than for profit, they certainly are maybe an alternative to the exaction extraction model. They can lever in funds through alternative means, such as the tax credit approach, which will gain equity to bring in other institutional partners that will be able to fund projects. So it might vary depending on the particular real estate sector. So whether it's sort of more commercial, sort of buy to let, sort of less socially orientated approaches. It goes back to this. It's a blend of instruments. It's sector differentials.
This issue of the cost of doing business in a particular locality, and I guess it's the less desirable areas or the less economically vibrant areas, you've got less leverage over the developers or the privates, you know, in terms of what they can extract, if you like, in that.
Yeah, and I think it's a question of scale as well, because some of the, if you look at site level, some of the scale of some of these sites are former on former contaminated naval bases, and you think of the huge costs that go into visioning the strategy and connecting it up with other parts of the city, is a whole different ball game to developing, you know, half a dozen condos with a percentage of affordable housing units attached to it. So it's cross-sectoral. I mean, some parcels of land will include hospitals, university campuses, mixed-use commercial centres, senior housing, on areas where some areas where no one lives, so you've got no issues of incumbent residents, and then other areas where it's highly populated and there's contestations between the residents. So I think, yeah, scale is certainly an important part of this. And I think one thing we didn't mention about was the influence of international money. And these are sort of some of the lessons that we can learn around the globe as well. And if we look at one of the cases in the Bay Area, where, you know, up to sort of 60% of that financial mix that goes into the blend is from foreign funds. There's say the EB5 scheme, where say someone from a Chinese development firm could put money into a project and enable and if that triggered X amount of jobs and put in X amount of money, it would enable them to start a base for their development company within that nationality. So I think foreign money, and we're starting to see that in the UK as well. Some work I'm doing in Western Europe, looking at different financial innovation, and Battersea, for instance, has got, you know, a huge amount of Malaysian money that's gone into that project. So you can start to see that, you know, sort of transnational foreign direct investment coming into these projects. Maybe that's at the top end of things. You know, your affordable housing provider, whether they can lever institutional money at that magnitude, maybe not. Yeah, if it's part of a big scheme, maybe. But you start to find affordable housing consolidation and co-financing is a way that a lot of affordable housing providers are starting to compete at that sort of level by working together. So, to say in the UK, the housing associations coming together and thinking how they can sort of bring in institutional money to work together and generate economies of scale and reduce their costs, etc. So in the US, there's a housing partnership that's starting to lever instruments such as like REITs, you know, real estate investment trusts, which are sort of traditionally in that sort of commercial scale, but bringing that into the housing sector is quite a new and interesting challenge, and whether that can be translated to, say, the UK model, where it's traditionally, well, the Western European model, where it's traditionally coming from a different trajectory, I'd say, sort of coming from that sort of social tradition rather than an Anglo-Saxon.
Certainly getting REITs to work outside the commercial property sector has proved too elusive in the UK. I mean, they've had a go and they've not succeeded. I mean, one thing I was wondering, I mean, is there a sort of, from the people you talked to in the research you did in the US, is there sort of a standout example of a successful project? You say, actually, this is, you know, they got everything working together, the partnership, you know, we captured the value, you delivered the infrastructure, the affordable housing, whatever. I mean, was there, you know, did people refer to sort of particular schemes that sort of actually, this is sort of the paradigm we point you to?
I mean, the city authority has its flagship schemes that it sort of promotes and pushes. There's the Trans Bay initiative, I suppose, is the predominant one, which is going to be a mixed-use site near the Bay Bridge. People remember the earthquake of the 80s, you know, the famous bridge that collapsed. So there's it's near to there, near to the Port Authority, which is a large landowner and can have a lot of leverage and lease opportunities as part of that ownership. But in the Trans Bay area, where it's sort of centred around transport as well, and that's seen to be one of these multi-sector, multi-financed. It's going to connect spatially to other areas of the bay easily. It's proposed that it will connect anecdotally, whether this yes, this is more probably anecdotal, but connecting with Los Angeles, a Hyperloop link. So we've got these large-scale sort of transport connectivities, as well as a more localized hub to other areas to try and take the heat out of San Francisco City itself and dissipate some of the heat that's been generated.
And that's a project that's just getting started, or...?
It's been underway a couple of years, but I think a few of the towers are up now, and the high rises are starting to develop from that. So Trans Bay seems to be sort of one of the flagship schemes.
And is there an example of a sort of unsuccessful attempt at bringing these sort of mechanisms to play that people were willing to own up to?
I think
they just sort of fell apart.
When you ask that question, sort of eyes turn back to the sort of 60s and 70s.
Oh, right. We've learned our lessons.
Yeah, it's sort of the problem of just putting state money into affordable housing projects. You know, there's like the Hope 6 projects in the US that sort of were, there's still skepticism about how much that warehoused the poor in terms of just putting state subsidies and that's it into an area, and how that can create barriers, walls, blockages, very, very clear divisions between communities just through that block direct subsidy approach. So I think when you ask that question, it's, well, we don't want to repeat of that sort of warehousing of the poor approach.
Yes.
We want something that's flexible, something that's uses the appropriate instruments and tools for the right context, and I think that's sort of the lesson that sort of comes through this.
I guess that context question sort of does raise an interesting issue of you know, transferability or learning lessons from this. You know, it's based in a particular governance context in terms of, you know, autonomy at local level, as well as a particular sort of economic context. You know, vibrant economy in US terms, you know, extremely successful economy. To what extent do these sorts of lessons, I mean, I know that that's not what your report necessarily spends a lot of time thinking about, that sort of work for the future is to think about lesson learning and policy transfer and things, but I mean, what's your feeling? Is your feeling actually that some of these things won't travel well out of the US, or there is some sort of mileage in this?
I think, on that question, I think, well, first of all, I don't think it's be fair to say, well, the US is, you know, booming, everything, you know, this is a model of growth, because within the Bay Area there are, you know, former industrial areas that were close to bankruptcy, and this was sort of a one of the key elements that enabled this case study to be able to generate lessons to be learned is because of, well, if we don't want to repeat problems of potential bankruptcy, if there's a shift towards localism and local areas having a greater control over their finances, you know, we don't want to build in risk into the system. So I think the question is, we need to sort of think just beyond growth models and include shrinking city models as well into how we finance cities. So in terms of transferability, with that in mind, I think there's always the ability to make some sort of comparative analysis. And if I'm going to shamelessly put a plug in for the book I've done,
please do.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's co-edited with a colleague, Erwin Herkins, looking at international approaches to real estate development. And what we've done there is to try and bring out some theory of how we can compare at a national scale these elements of outcomes, implementation, geographies, approaches, and see if you can compare a particular, say if it was policy, you can compare a single policy over two different contexts. So say if it was in a growth, a city that's been growing on a certain trajectory or is in a certain boom point. And you can also compare that policy in an area that's been declining, for instance. You know, you can always draw parallels maybe between, say, you know, Detroit as a classic sort of collapsing city, and say your Manchester's and Liverpool's have experienced sort of industrial decline at a rapid scale since the 70s. And then you could maybe compare, say, San Francisco, London as examples of booming models. So there's a certain element you can make comparisons within two different contexts of one policy, but then also we can look at a blend of policies within one context and see how that blend works in another context as well. So it's sort of can start to get a little bit abstract in the way we sort of conceive these things, but if we accept that a city has certain structures, certain functions, certain dynamics that are true in two different areas, you can start to use a particular policy approach and see if it will similarly work in another area. Obviously, every individual area is sure. Goes through its, you know, very individual demographic change and dynamics. But I think there's some room there to make those comparisons.
And is that a project that you're sort of hoping to develop further and take some of this stuff and really ground it in some concrete comparisons?
Yeah, I think so. And my sort of nervousness about this is because it's sort of future work. But
sure.
I think there's certainly some mileage here in terms of comparability, because there's been a long tradition in the last sort of decade, I'd say, in academic research to just look at a case study because it can only sit within its own context. But I think certainly geography is opening up a lot more to comparative analysis, and I think at a national scale that can be done, and certainly at a city scale, because in terms of seeing the bigger picture, you can start to certainly draw lessons from making those comparisons. And I think in terms of policy transfer, and if we talk directly at that individual tool, that might be a little bit more tricky to sort of think. You know, it's possible to think that something can be transplanted as a policy in its entirety to another area, but it's, I think the jury's out on that one, that it can be just sort of directly transferred. You know, for instance, say enterprise zones, which went from the UK to the US, back to the UK again, it was a very different animal by the time it had done that full loop. Mm-hmm. So so there has to be some caution when taking an instrument and thinking that will be able to deal with the same problem.
Even if it succeeds where it started, in the context in which it started, it may well not succeed.
Yeah.
In a context, if you transplant it, for sure.
Yeah. An analogy that was given to me with, say, tax increment financing, you know, it's a new, you know, it could be perceived as something new in the UK, even though it's been going on, you know, 60 years in the US. Is that, you know, once you've got a hammer, everything else looks like a nail. Mm-hmm. You know, so people are trying to use that instrument to sort of as a silver bullet to deal with all the problems.
But this is some complexity that's to be wrestled with in future.
Indeed.
Rather than name, right?
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Well, that's helpful. So anyway, so I think probably we should draw time to go to a close now, Graham. So just to remind people, so the report is called The Future Financing of Real Estate Development in Cities, looking at the Bay Area, published by RICS. You can get it from RICS.org. Thanks, Graham, and I look forward to hearing about the next phase of the work and the policy transfer, lessons learned and the likes. I'm sure there'll be plenty of people interested in knowing if there are mechanisms that we can identify that can be transferred. Not incautious transfer, but, you know, well evidenced, well grounded, thought through mechanisms that may well work. And I'm sure there's going to be a ready policy audience for hearing about them. Anyway, cheers. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Alex.
That's all for this episode of Policy Unpacked. Thanks for listening, and I hope you found it interesting. I hope you join me next time when I'll be exploring another contemporary policy issue, and I hope that next time comes around a little bit quicker than the gap between episode 4 and episode 5. So don't forget that this policy podcast is available through iTunes. Search for either Policy Unpacked or Alex's Archives. And also now you can follow it on SoundCloud. So I have my own SoundCloud page as well. And if that's not enough, you can always follow me on Twitter as ShowdanAlexM. Until next time, goodbye.